RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
My name is Alistair Harding, and today on Reality Check Radio, on our very first edition of Our Digital Future, we're looking at Google, its business model of surveillance and manipulation, and what it's capable of, and what it means for our future. Make no mistake, this story is the story of the century. What Google is capable of is mass manipulation, previously only ever thought about in terms of authoritarian governments found in the pages of books, like 1984. Under our noses, Google has built a surveillance network over the past 20 years that tracks our movements all over the internet. It listens to your conversations through mobile phones and home devices like Alexa. It sends Street View cars through our neighborhoods collecting our Wi-Fi data. Google reads your personal messages, your emails. It scans your documents on their servers. And then they do deals with schools and businesses and governments. And no doubt, they do it all again to them as well. And all of it is completely unregulated. Quite literally, they are the biggest surveillance operation in history. And with that information, they can move votes in elections and cause billions of people to act on information fed to them. If this didn't impact every one of us, it would be an awe-inspiring story of human innovation. But instead, it's simply scary. And to explain all of that and more, I have with me today Dr. Robert Epstein, the world-renowned researcher who's been shining the light on Google with pioneering work revealing the power that Google doesn't want you to know it has. Dr. Robert Epstein is an author, a professor, and he's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology, a non-profit, non-partisan organization that researches the power of Google and other big tech companies. He's appeared on the Joe Rogan Experience, where I first encountered him, as well as documentaries such as The Creepy Line, which discusses this very subject. And now he joins us here on Reality Check Radio for the first edition of Our Digital Future. So welcome to Reality Check Radio, Dr. Robert Epstein. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Okay, so let's get into it. You're known for a lot of different types of research, but these days you're mostly known for your research into Google and how they manipulate us. And in an overarching way, this is encompassed by the term that you've coined, the search engine manipulation effect. What is that?
Well, we call it SEM for short, S-E-M-E. Which stands for search engine manipulation effect. And that is the effect, unfortunately, that biased search results can have on people's opinions and their voting preferences and their beliefs and their attitudes if initially they're undecided. In other words, if they are vulnerable to being influenced, it turns out the search engine is probably the most powerful mind control machine ever invented in the history of humanity. That how Google, or perhaps even other search engines, how they structure that page of results when you ask a question or you type in a search term, that can have an enormous impact on you if, again, you're undecided on some issue.
So these are all the topics we're going to get talking about today. How did this journey start for you? Can you take us through that briefly?
Well, that's really pretty simple. I should point out that I've been programming computers since I was a teenager. So when on January the 1st, 2012, I got 9 messages from Google, 9 emails, saying my website had been hacked and we're blocking access to it, because it contains dangerous malware. Well, I got really curious about Google. For the first thing I asked myself was, who made them the sheriff of the internet? Well, it turns out no one did. They made themselves the sheriff. You know, why wasn't I getting emails from some government agency or some nonprofit organization, some consortium of tech companies? I don't know. Why was it Google? So that was interesting. And then I also began to wonder, as a programmer, how they were blocking access, not just through the Google search engine and through Chrome, which is Google's browser, you know, through Google software. But they were blocking access somehow through Firefox, which is a browser created by a nonprofit organization called Mozilla. They were blocking access through Safari, which is Safari is an Apple product.
It's almost as if they own the internet now.
Well, yes. In fact, I was just telling one of my research associates here a few minutes ago something that really, really shocked him. I said to him, did you know that on January 31st of the year 2009, Google blocked access to the entire internet for 40 minutes? Mm. And he said, you mean they blocked access to Google products or Google services? I said, no. No, I meant what I said. They blocked access to the entire internet for 40 minutes. This was covered by The Guardian. Google did not deny it.
2009, they blocked access to the internet to everyone in the world.
That's right. And I finally figured out why they chose the particular time they did. U.S. time, it was in Pacific time, it was about 6 a.m., 6 in the morning in California on a Saturday. And I finally figured out why they picked that time. That's one of the only hours out of all the hours in the week when all the stock markets are closed. So in other words, they picked an hour when they could shut everything down and have their fun and not panic the world and not have too many people care about what they just did.
Why would they do that? Is it a warning shot? Is it trying to tell somebody something? We can do this?
I can answer that too. It's because they're geeks. And this is what we geeks do for fun. And this is what we geeks do to show how cool we are and how powerful we are. And maybe we can get a date this way. This is a very powerful company. They know it. There are no restrictions on them whatsoever in law or regulation. Australia tried and failed. The EU has tried and failed. In the US, we've never even tried because they've bought all the Democrat politicians. And Republicans here don't like regulation. So the US, we haven't even tried to stop them. But the EU has tried and failed. Australia has tried and failed.
Here in New Zealand, they just gave up.
They gave up. They gave up.
Yeah, they've just given up. Okay, so I'd like to build the picture from the bottom. What sort of information are we giving Google every day? I mean, most people, you talk to them, they know that Google's building profiles on us all, and we all just sort of say, oh, that's okay. They're just, you know, we know we're not that comfortable with it, but they're just selling advertising. But then they're not really understanding how much they're actually scraping of the internet of us. We're talking about web browsers, search results, operating systems, phones, home devices. They've even been found to be collecting Wi-Fi data via their Street View cars. This is an all-encompassing effort to scrape every little bit of information they have about us and build profiles on all of us, isn't it?
Well, I would say that's an understatement because a few years ago, they bought the Nest smart thermostat company. And some smartass like me figured out about a year later that Google was installing microphones into some of Nest's products. At the same time, I found out that Google was getting patents on methods for analyzing sounds inside the home. They were actually getting patents on these methods so that they could figure out from the sounds, well, whether people are on vacation, whether the kids are okay, whether the sex life is okay. So they put microphones into some of these Nest products without anyone knowing that they were doing it. Then a couple of years ago, they bought Fitbit so that they have access to all the physiological data that those Fitbit devices are collecting on millions of people, tens of millions. In fact, Google is monitoring us when we're online and offline through close to 200 different platforms, most of which people never even heard of. So the surveillance is unparalleled in human history. The Stasi from East Germany never came close. J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI in the United States, never came close. What Google does on the surveillance side is unprecedented in human history. It's truly astonishing. I'll give you just another couple just crazy examples.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, millions of websites use Google Analytics to track the traffic that comes to their websites, because Google so generously allows people to use Google Analytics without charging them. Oh, another one of those free products that are not really free. That means, by the way, under Google's terms of service, which I've read several times, that means that since you, when you visit such and such a website, so it's a website for, you know, your favorite hairdresser, the fact is, if that hairdresser is using Google Analytics, that means Google has the right to track every single thing you do on that website. So that's millions of websites are tracking you for Google without you having the slightest idea that this is occurring.
Who's regulating this?
Well, here's another example. My phone is a secure phone. So we build these phones for our staff who, you know, do sensitive kinds of studies. But everyone else, in fact, most people around the world use Android phones. Well, Android is Google.
Mm.
And Android monitors every single thing you do on your phone, everything you read, all the music you listen to, the phone calls you make. They're recording, those phones are recording all the sounds and transmitting the sounds to Google. About, I think it's last I read, it was about 12 megabytes of data a day. And you look kind of old enough to remember back a few years when you could pull the batteries out of your phones,
yep,
and put in new ones.
Yep.
Now you can't. Now they're soldered in. Well, and people think, oh yeah, they soldered them in, so I have to throw my phone away when the battery gets weak. That's not why they did it. They did it so you could never turn your phone off. So even when you think your phone is off, it's still listening and it's still tracking your location. Most people in the world today are carrying very powerful surveillance devices without knowing it. My beautiful wife, whom I miss desperately, she was killed in a car accident a few years ago. After she died, my daughter showed me how to get stuff out of her phone. Misty was her name. And among other things, it was an Android phone. There was a complete history of every single place she had been since she got that phone. And every place she had been, the addresses, how long she had stayed at each place, the routes that she took, not to mention textual content, photos, yeah, all the stuff that we kind of know we're putting on the phone. But there was so much additional on that phone that it's like I was getting to know my own wife all over again. There was so much on that phone. So these are very, very powerful surveillance devices. Now, we have, at least in the U.S., we have regulations that govern the telephone industry, the newspapers, magazines, radios, televisions. We have regulations. There are no regulations, no laws restricting the kinds of activities that these new internet companies can engage in. They're none. They're like gods.
And these are companies which now have revenues and cash reserves greater than most countries.
Yes, Google is bringing in more than $200 billion a year now. I think they're past 250, and they have more than $200 billion liquid in the bank.
So it's no surprise then that they can perhaps lobby the US government to make sure that none of these regulations do come to pass as well.
Google is the biggest lobbyist in Washington, D.C. In the Obama administration, Google executives were in charge of seven federal agencies in Washington, D.C. Obama's chief technology officer, former Google executive, Hillary Clinton's largest donor, Google. Hillary Clinton's chief technology officer's name was Stephanie Hannon, former Google executive. We're talking about a company, again, where they're not only are there no restrictions, but they have just taken control wherever they can. And again, there's no, you know, there are a couple of countries that have tried with laws or regulations to get Google under control. They've failed completely.
Is there enough evidence to actually show that perhaps this is actually part of a worldwide intelligence operation, that perhaps the CIA is involved? Or is that just taking it a step too far?
Well, Google has worked very closely with intelligence agencies in the U.S. and outside the U.S. Since before the Google company was even incorporated. So they were working with the CIA and the NSA. They were actually getting funding from them before Google was even made a company back in the 1990s. And they've continued to have a very close relationship with intelligence agencies around the world, not just in the U.S. And some of that is legitimate, quite legitimate, because the intelligence agencies, they were you know, talking to the people developing these search engines, because they thought, trying to look ahead into the future, they thought that people who were a threat to national security would make themselves known by going to these search engines and asking questions like, how do I build a bomb? So that's legitimate. So yes, Google and to a lesser extent, some of the other tech companies work with intelligence agencies, because the intelligence agencies are constantly looking for ways to protect us from threats to national security. That's real. Now, is there a worldwide cabal that kind of, you know, gets governments and billionaires and the big tech companies all on one page, all working together, you know, toward world government? Not that I know of. In fact, my thinking is quite the opposite, in the sense that I think if there is any one big controller out there, it's probably Google. I think they have a lot more power than any government has ever had. And I think where they cooperate with governments, they do so because it benefits them. But they're the ones with the real power. They have more power than any government has ever had, especially on the surveillance side. But not just surveillance, but manipulation. Take surveillance and manipulation and put them together, and you just can't beat that. And
well, isn't that what Mussolini was talking about when he talked about fascism? He said that fascism should really be called corporatism, because it was the merging of government and business.
Well, yeah, but I have to emphasize that we've entered a very different kind of world. We're not in the world of Brave New World or 1984, where the government is in control and the government is doing most of the surveillance. We've entered a very different world that no one really had predicted. And that's where the couple of corporations are really in control. And they're the ones who are doing most of the surveillance. I mean, there's never been an agency, a government anywhere around the world that does, you know, that tracks people as aggressively as Google does, and to a lesser extent Facebook, and that gives them enormous power. One of our new research areas is on what's called the DPE, or the digital personalization effect. I'll just give you one very quick example of one of our recent findings. So this is brand new stuff, not published yet. But what we show is that with biased content, we can produce shifts of 20% or more in a particular experiment. If we then show people the same biased content, but we personalize it, so in other words, we'll send it to them so it looks like it's coming from news sources that they trust, that 20% jumps up to over 60%, and more than triples. So now we're talking about power that these companies have that we never even imagined. We knew that biased content could shift people's thinking and behavior, but now if you add in personalization, the effect triples in size. That's the power, the crazy, insane power that these companies have, and no government has that kind of power. So I think we're in a world that just no one really quite anticipated, where it's the corporations that are the real threat to humanity, or as they see it, the corporations are the real saviors of humanity. But I don't see it that way.
Okay, so this is not all just you surmising. You've researched the manipulation effects of Google. And probably the best example of this is the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. This is where I first heard you talking about this on the Joe Rogan show. Because they're not just selling ads, are they? They're actually shifting votes. They're in a way sort of conducting an orchestra. And I'm talking about all the list bias effects, the targeted messages, the ephemeral search results. Can you take us through that? What did you find? What did you see? And what happened in your view?
Let's start with that phrase you mentioned, ephemeral messages or ephemeral content. In 2018, there was a leak of emails from Google to the Wall Street Journal. And in that conversation, Google employees were discussing how they might be able to use, quote, ephemeral experiences, that's their phrase, to change people's views about Trump's travel ban. Okay, so what are they talking about here? Why do they care about ephemeral experiences? Because ephemeral means fleeting. Ephemeral experiences refers to those experiences you have online when, let's say, you type in a search term and some search suggestions are flashed at you. Those are ephemeral. They're fleeting. They might affect what you end up clicking on, what you end up searching for, but they're disappearing very fast. And when they disappear, they're gone forever. They're not stored anywhere. Anyway, a list of search results appears below. Possibly even an answer box might appear, which just gives you the answer. It gives you the answer and then it disappears. It's ephemeral. Mm. The search results down below, if you click on one of them, they all disappear and they're gone forever and they're not stored anywhere. So the advantage of using ephemeral experiences to manipulate people is that there's no way authorities can go back in time and find out what you did. In other words, there's no paper trail for anyone to follow.
No smoking gun.
No, there's no smoking gun. And so now let me just go through those three cases I just mentioned. The search suggestions that are flashing at you. Okay.
Yeah.
Can they be used to manipulate? Yes. In fact, we have a paper right now that's about to be published on what we call SSE, the search suggestion effect. And we've shown in controlled experiments that you can use search suggestions. You can fiddle with search suggestions in such a way as to turn a 50-50 split among undecided voters into a 90-10 split with no one having the slightest idea that they have been manipulated. Now, let's say you get past the search suggestions, they give you an answer box. Well, we already published a scientific paper on this. We call it ABE, the answer bot effect, answer bot, which applies not just to answer boxes, but it applies to those answers that you get from your digital personal assistants, like Siri and Alexa. We've shown that just by manipulating the content of answer boxes, which people really trust answers from Siri and Alexa and Google Home, which is their own personal digital personal assistant. We've shown that if we just give someone a biased answer, one biased answer to one question, that can produce a shift of 40% or more among undecided voters. Just one biased answer among people who are undecided. What if we give them the same kind of biased answer multiple times? Then we can get shifts over 60%.
That's incredible.
And can they do that? Can they give you a similarly biased content over and over again? Oh, yeah. That's one of our most recent research projects. So it's called MEE, Multiple Exposure Effect. And it's unbelievable.
And did I understand it correctly? I watched you talking on the The Creepy Line, a fantastic documentary that's available on YouTube for people to view if they want to know more about this subject. But on there, you talked about how in some of your early experiments, actually looking at the Australian elections, the more biased the search results were, the more likely, even if people could see that they were biased search results, the more likely they were actually to be influenced by those search results as well, right?
That's one of the creepiest findings from our research over and over again, that the very few people who can see the bias, and we're usually talking, 5%, most people cannot see bias, but here and there, now and then, someone says they see the bias.
Wow.
They shift even farther in the direction of the bias. In other words, merely seeing the bias does not protect you from the bias. Those people end up concluding, well, the algorithm prefers that candidate. And algorithms, as we all know, are impartial and and honest. And
therefore, I can trust it even more. Even though I can see it's biased, it must be real.
It must be, that's right, it must be true. And of course, now the same, now we're getting even into deeper, whatever you want to call it, because of the AIs. Because again, people are especially trusting of AIs. People have absolutely no idea how these things work. And they don't see the human element. They don't see that it's humans building these things and that their own biases get built into the algorithms. And they also don't see the adjustments that are being made. Google has blacklists and whitelists, for example. And one of the simplest ways you can control your algorithms so they don't get out of control too much is you have them check a blacklist or check a whitelist before they give the answer. Now, I'm going to actually tell you exactly how this works and how it worked in the summer of 2016 with Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was on Google's whitelist. Donald Trump was on Google's blacklist. So if you searched for Hillary Clinton on Google, you could not get negative search suggestions. It only gave positive search suggestions. It gave suggestions like Hillary Clinton is winning. Hillary Clinton is awesome. If you typed in Hillary Clinton is, if you typed Hillary Clinton is on Yahoo or Bing, you got what people were actually searching for, which was Hillary Clinton is the devil. Hillary Clinton drinks blood. Hillary Clinton, whatever. You got all the crazy stuff on Bing and Yahoo, but not on Google because Google had whitelisted her.
Wow.
Now, when I testified before the United States Congress in 2019, before I testified, a Google executive did, and he was asked under oath, sir, does Google have blacklists and whitelists? And he said, no, Senator, we do not. That was the answer. He said that under oath. Now, 3 weeks later, roughly speaking, one of the Google whistleblowers who left the company walked out of that company with 950 pages of documents and a video. And three of those documents were labeled blacklists.
They even called them blacklists.
They even called them blacklists. Talk about arrogance. Talk about hubris. They even called them blacklists. Now, if you were creating blacklists at your company, would you call them blacklists? I wouldn't. No, I would call them, shopping list.
The laundry list, the shopping list. Yeah.
Something. I would not call them blacklists, but this isn't just fearlessness, okay? This is extreme arrogance. This is like when they shut down the whole internet for 40 minutes. This is the kind of people we're talking about. They, in fact, I know someone who wrote a whole book about some of the key people in Silicon Valley. And that's the whole theme of the book were that these were megalomaniacs. I get it. I do get it because no one's ever come after them. It's almost like, Donald Trump, now they're going after him. He's still pretty fearless, but no one's ever gone after Google except in the EU. And all that's happened is they've got some fines and they've other than that, completely ignored all the, all the rules and regulations that have been put in place. They've made agreements with the government there, completely ignored every single thing they promised.
Okay, but in the case of the 2016 presidential election, Trump actually won. So what effect did it really have?
Well, Trump lost the popular vote by about 2.8 million votes. That's never happened before. So Trump won by a tiny, tiny margin, 77,000 votes in four swing states. So in other words, in the United States, there's only one office which has a buffer that's supposed to protect who can fill that office, and that's the presidency. So anything else in the United States, dog catcher, mayor, governor, you name it, it's a simple majority that determines who wins, but not for the presidency, because the framers of our Constitution said that office is too important. We don't want a demagogue getting in there. We don't want a king getting in there. We have to protect this office. So they created something called the Electoral College. And each state has a certain number of members, just a handful of people. And originally, the Electoral College members could vote according to their conscience. So that was the idea. They could vote according to their conscience, and in that conscience, that way we wouldn't get a crazy person into that office of presidency. That's how the country would be protected. But over the years, over the centuries, the states, one by one, took away that discretionary power of the members of the Electoral College, and said all the Electoral College members had to vote for whoever got the majority of votes in that state. Now, this is a very bad system. That's not what the system was supposed to be like. And that's how Trump won, because in a couple of states, which are called swing states, which could have gone either way, his total win margin was 77,000 votes that put him over the top in the vote of the Electoral College. That's what happened. And the people at Google immediately had an emergency meeting, and this was a leak from the company. All the leaders of Google up on a stage talking to all 100,000 members of Google's staff, and one after one saying, "We are never going to let this happen again. Never. We're never going to let this happen again." So the mere fact that they're saying that tells you something right there, that they thought they were in control of the outcome. And I was saying before the election that based on my research, that Google could easily shift between 2.6 and 10.4 million votes in the election. That's what I was saying publicly. Well, Clinton actually won by a margin of 2.8 million votes. If you just look at the national vote, the simple vote. And I was right. I was exactly right. So what that means is if you took Google out of that picture in 2016, the popular vote would have been tied, very likely. It would have been tied. She wouldn't have had that big lead that she had in the national vote. As it turns out, though, the people at Google weren't paying attention in detail to a couple of swing states. They weren't paying attention because they thought everyone knew, all the polls said that Hillary was going to win.
Maybe they were reading their search results a little bit too much.
Well, they were obviously overconfident. I'll give you another example. There's one effect that we've discovered is called targeted messaging effect. Here's how it works. If on election day itself, Mark Zuckerberg sent out go vote reminders, say just to Democrats, people who would vote for Hillary Clinton, well, no one would have known that he did it. And it would have given Hillary Clinton that day nationwide more than 450,000 additional votes. That's all Mark had to do was send out go vote reminders in a targeted fashion, in a partisan fashion. That's all he had to do. And by the way, he had put up many, many millions of dollars, possibly hundreds of millions, supporting Hillary Clinton. And I'm sure he kicked himself afterwards because I don't think he sent out those go vote reminders. But he could have. And then one little click on his keyboard, and millions of Democrats would have got go vote reminders all day long on election day. And that would have got a lot more people to vote for her. But he didn't send it. He was overconfident.
Okay, so this is measurable differences we're talking about. So then I think to myself about the places that Google have embedded themselves in society. And I know, for example, Google have embedded themselves in schools. And they've actually been caught scraping students. And I mean, by that, I mean children's email and personal data. That's a reported fact. And they've never been held to account for that or had to explain what they're doing with that data. And I look at New Zealand and I see that we've been in partnership with Google since 2007. Our Ministry of Education signed a deal with them to provide Google products for our schools. And I also see that some of our biggest companies that you won't have heard of, but they're household names to our listeners, companies like The Warehouse and Trade Me and media organizations like NZME, they all use Google's cloud services. So Google has access to all of those emails and documents and all of that kind of stuff as well. And it's not just that. I go further and I look and I see that last year in December 2023, our government, through the Department of Internal Affairs, they just signed off on an all-of-government cloud framework agreement with Google Cloud. So my question is this. If Google have got the ability to move votes and influence elections through collecting of search data and phone data and listening to what's going on in our homes through our phones and Alexa and all of that. And not only that, they've also been caught sucking up, this is another verifiable fact, they've been caught sucking up Wi-Fi data from their Street View cars in the past. And as I said, they've been collecting children's personal data through schools programs. They've demonstrated that they can't really be trusted with this incredibly sensitive, all-encompassing information. And we also know that they've been using this stuff to manipulate us. So what does this mean for our governments? What does this mean for our societies in general when they've got this much information that they're working with?
Well, depending on the country, we'd have to go one by one, but depending on the country, for most countries, it means that we have turned over control of the country to Google. Oddly enough, Facebook, which is almost as big as Google, they're not so interested in controlling humanity and controlling the world. But Google was founded by two utopians who hired a lot of people that think like they do. One of the leaks from Google a couple of years ago was an 8-minute video made by their advanced products division entitled "The Selfish Ledger."
Okay.
I'm not even going to explain what that means because it's a stupid title. But the point is, in this 8-minute video, which was never meant to be seen outside the company, Google employees explain that Google has the power to re-engineer humanity according to, and this is right, comes from the film, right from the video, according to Google's values. That's what it says.
This is Google's own words.
Yeah. The point is that we're talking about people who feel like they know better. They know how everyone should live and how everyone should think. And they're out to reshape the humanity to match their own values. And you know what? I don't blame them. I don't blame them at all. No one's ever restricted them in any way. They have the resources. If you had the resources and you had some very strong values and wouldn't you kind of want to impose them if you had, as a do-gooder, if you thought of yourself as a do-gooder, wouldn't you want to impose?
Well, this is the argument that Jordan Peterson would talk about, right? That we all have the tyrant within us,
yeah.
That we just don't know it until we have the opportunity.
Well, not only that, when you're in that mode, you don't see yourself as a tyrant.
Mm.
And I know people who work there. I even know people who want to become whistleblowers and haven't blown the whistle yet. They don't think of themselves as tyrants at all. They think of themselves as saviors. We have the God-given ability to save humankind. And And we invented the equipment and wrote the software that can make this happen. So we're doing it. And they're actually doing it. Now, how do I know? I know we're going a little tight on time here, so I'm going to shift you over to a different part of my research, different part of my work. How do we know what they're actually doing? Well, we do know partly because there have been about a dozen whistleblowers now, and a lot of documents, PowerPoint presentations, videos, a lot of leaks. So we know from leaks. But I know that they're actually doing these things because in 2015, the attorney general of one of our states called me up and he asked me whether Google could screw with his upcoming re-election for attorney general. And I said, yes, I explained how. And then he said, but how would you know they're doing it? And I was stumped. And he said, well, in law enforcement, we would set up fake people. He said, we call them sock puppets. Now we call them bots. We would set up fake people online and we would see what they're sending. I said, well, that wouldn't work because Google's algorithm would recognize that those aren't real people because they don't have profiles on Google. If you've been using the internet for 20 years, Google has collected the equivalent of more than 3 million pages of information about you. So they sure as heck can distinguish between a real person and a bot. And when they are confronted with a bot, they don't send biased content. They send unbiased content. We know this because we monitor them now. So that brings me to monitoring. Because as a result of that phone call, I became obsessed with trying to figure out how could I find out what they're really doing? And I realized the only way to do it is you'd have to look over the shoulders of a very large number of real people. And you'd have to do this without Google knowing you're doing it. You'd have to look over their shoulders and collect what they're seeing on their screens. And then you'd have to aggregate that information very quickly and analyze it. Now you can see whether there really was bias, whether they're sending different content to conservatives and liberals, what they're sending to children. You could see the whole thing, but you have to be looking over the shoulders of real people. And I thought, how are we going to find those people? Early 2016, before the presidential election, we got some money, which allowed us to recruit our first field agents. In 2016, we had 95 field agents in 24 U.S. states who had allowed us to put special software in their computers, which is invisible to Google, and collect political content that Google was sending them on their screens. We also collected content from Bing and Yahoo, just for comparison's sake. And what did we find? We found extreme pro-Hillary Clinton bias on Google, but not on Bing or Yahoo. We found enough bias, we knew this from our experiments, enough bias to cause between 2.6 and 10.4 million votes to be shifted to Hillary Clinton without anyone knowing that this was occurring. We collected the evidence. We preserved 13,000 searches on Google, Bing, and Yahoo, and the 100,000 web pages to which those searches linked.
Sorry, just to clarify, what you're doing is you're taking photos of the people in your study of their phones as they do searches, as they use their phones or as they use their computers. Is that right? And then you're storing that and studying it.
Yeah, we're screenshotting, we're screen grabbing, and we're pulling all that content, and then we're archiving it and analyzing it. And we learned how to do it faster and faster and faster.
So you're using real people. So all those profiles are intact.
That's the only way it works. So these couple of studies that have been done, which I'm writing about now in a new article, claiming that there is no political bias on Google, paid for usually. Those studies are paid for by Google, by the way. But those studies are absolute nonsense because they never involve real people. They always involve bots or anonymized computers. But what you have to look over the shoulders of real people, and they have to be people that Google hasn't located. We set up bigger and bigger systems from election to election to election. 2022 midterms, we had not 95 field agents, we had 2,742 field agents, mainly in just in swing states. We didn't preserve 13,000 ephemeral experiences. We preserved more than 2.5 million ephemeral experiences. And we found overwhelming evidence of political bias on Google. And I decided after that election, the time had come to build a large-scale, permanent, nationwide system, the world's first. And that system now exists, and there's even a dashboard where the public can see what we're collecting. It's at americasdigitalshield.com. That's Americas with an S, digitalshield.com. And you will see a live dashboard that's showing you that as of right now, we have preserved more than 89 million ephemeral experiences on Google, Bing, Yahoo, YouTube. You know, those recommendations YouTube makes, those are highly biased and manipulative, and we're preserving them, and we're preserving content that they're sending to thousands of children. And we're building up a larger and larger archive. And guess what this is going to do? This is going to make Google and other companies for the first time accountable to the public, which they have never been. Even without laws and regulations, if you have in place a large-scale monitoring system, you're making them accountable because you're capturing the content they're sending to people. And by the way, if you do pass some laws, you won't know that those laws are actually being followed. You won't know whether there's compliance unless you set up a monitoring system. The only way to know is with a monitoring system. If you have no monitoring system, you have no idea what these companies are doing, period. And by the way, that means they're not accountable and they can do whatever they want.
How can you keep them to account? I mean, we're talking about the entire internet here.
Well, we've already heard from people and officials in seven other countries who want us to help them set up monitoring systems. Eventually, every country in the world will have systems like our system, because this is necessary, not just to keep Google under control, but the next Google and the Google after that. You have to have monitoring systems in place. If you don't, you have no idea what they have done. Now, if any of your audience wants to help us, they can go to feedthewatchdogs.com.
Okay.
Feed the Watchdogs. Our field agents we now call Watchdogs. Feedthewatchdogs.com, and they can sign up and make a donation of $25 a month, which is all we pay these people. It's a token fee. And they can sponsor a watchdog. We have some people who signed up and are sponsoring five watchdogs or even more. And that helps, that cuts our cost, because it's, you know, when we got to 10,000 watchdogs, that was costing us $250,000 a month. So this is an expensive system to build. It costs $3 million to build it in 2023. It's an expensive system to run. And you know what? It doesn't matter. We have to do it. It's not really optional, because look at americasdigitalshield.com. Look at the content that YouTube, which is part of Google, that YouTube is recommending to children, because we're capturing that.
Is there any evidence that when we look over the last few years, we seem to be getting caught up in great hysterias that are taking place at greater and greater frequency? Is there any way you can speculate on whether this manipulation technology is being used to cause any of those events?
It is absolutely, positively the fault of these big tech companies. It's these big tech companies are causing the hysteria, because the more hysteria they create, the greater the watch time is what they call it. And the greater the watch time, the more money they make. So this was all confirmed just about a year and a half ago when Frances Haugen left Facebook, and she brought with her a bunch of internal emails in which their executives were basically saying what I just told you. That they liked that frenzy, the craziness. They like the conspiracy theories, because that drives traffic, that increases watch time, that increases income. So there is no question whatsoever that the chaos we're seeing around the world is largely caused or at least amplified by these big tech platforms, because the more the craziness, the more money they make, pure and simple. If you've never seen The Social Dilemma, which is features my friend Tristan Harris, who used to be a so-called design ethicist at Google. That's his job, was to help manipulate a billion people around the world every day. Watch The Social Dilemma. It's a Netflix film. If you want to see my research featured in a very good documentary, you go to creepyline.org, creepyline.org, and you can watch that movie for free. The point is, yes, to answer your question, yes, it's these companies, because that's how they get richer and richer and richer faster and faster, is cause this craziness to occur. And the monitoring project that confirms it, the monitoring archive that we've been building, that confirms that they are elevating certain content, that they're suppressing other content. And very often what they're doing is they're elevating content that makes people nuts, because that's how they make more money, much faster.
What makes me nuts is that it appears that you're the only one actually doing anything about this. Is there anyone else fighting this battle alongside you?
You know, that's what drove Joe Rogan nuts. And he actually, when I left his studio, he actually gave me his cell phone number. And I think it's because he was so concerned about that one issue. And he was concerned about my safety. He was. And by the way, there were four big guys standing right there outside of his studio. Huge men. Huge. And they all had beards. And they were so big that they looked like clones of each other. And I looked at one of them and I said, "Well, what do you do here?" And he looks down at me like I'm a little ant. And he says, "Security." And I said, "Security? I mean, people want to hurt Joe Rogan?" He said, "Oh, yeah." So Rogan, I think, was concerned about, you know, my own security and the security of my staff, my family members. I'm every day very concerned. We had a meeting about this just today, about the security of our data, because these companies do not want us to exist and they do not want our data to exist.
Okay, so we're running out of time now, so we're going to have to wrap this up. But I have to ask you, because this all sounds very depressing. It sounds like we're already in the pages of 1984. But is there perhaps some sort of silver lining you can see that perhaps by going through all of this, by seeing what it is and realizing how dangerous these companies can be if they're left unchecked, is there some sort of silver lining that we can end this talk on? That perhaps we're going to find out that by going through all of this, we discover how these technologies can be used for good and maybe make them be used for good.
Alistair, I wish I could, because, you know, it's good to get good messages, right? It makes people feel good. And I can't. All I can tell you is that we haven't even hit bottom yet. We're a long way away. We're going to hit bottom, though, pretty soon. 2-3 years, 5 years at the most. We're going to hit bottom because the AIs, at some point or other, are going to take control. And from that moment on, there's no telling what will happen. So that could mean the end of humanity, as great physicist Stephen Hawking predicted, as Elon Musk now and then predicts. It could mean that, like my old buddy Ray Kurzweil says, he's now head of engineering at Google, it could mean great things will happen for humanity. We'll partner up with computers and we'll all become happier and more productive and all that. I doubt that. No one knows what's going to happen exactly, but the point is the AIs are now being put into all of these systems that we all use every day. And Microsoft just announced yesterday that they're putting in ChatGPT 4.0, which is the new one. It's the state of the art. It's the one you can talk to. They're integrating ChatGPT 4.0 into all of their products, including their desktop computers. They're putting it into everything. And by the way, a man named Hinton, one of the top executives in AI at Google, quit a few weeks ago. And just a couple of days ago, one of the top people at OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, he also quit. Why are these top executives in AI quitting these AI projects? Because what they say is that their companies are moving too fast. They're putting money, income, wealth ahead of safety. Now, when you have some of the top people in the AI field quitting these companies, quitting fabulously paid jobs, that tells you that we probably are headed into a very, very bad period for humanity, because we've made ourselves more and more dependent on all this tech, and we're putting all this tech more and more under the control of algorithms that we can't control and that we don't understand. And that's what the next few years are going to be showing all of us. And I think things could go very, very badly for us. I hope we don't have to shut off the electricity worldwide to protect ourselves.
The ultimate opt-out situation. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, look, I've been working in the AI field practically my whole adult life, and I can tell you that we're rapidly heading towards unknown territory where terrible things could happen. And I don't think we're going to be able to stop whatever it is that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to be able to stop it, because we're just, all of our communications now are running through all this big tech stuff. And so are our financial transactions, and a lot of our major weapon systems are handled by these same networks. I think we're headed towards, we're heading into a very dangerous time for humanity.
Well, look, we'll have to wrap it up there. We have gone over time, but it's just been absolutely fascinating. I think we could talk all day about it, and our listeners would lap it up. We should do a whole series with you. I want to thank you for your efforts and what you're doing. It kind of looks at the moment like you're the little Dutch boy putting his finger in the dam, so to speak. So, you know, we will be putting out all of those website addresses where people can follow what you're doing, but also contribute to what you're doing. It's extremely important work. And, you know, thank you so much for spending the time with us today to talk about it.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for, you know, giving me an opportunity to let people know what's going on. People need to know. They need to understand. And if they're parents, they especially need to know that what kind of content their children are being subjected to, and how their children are being surveilled and controlled by tech companies. I mean, I'm a parent of five kids. I don't like thinking about it, but that's the reality. That's where we live. So thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's Dr. Robert Epstein, author, professor, and senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology, where he and his team have been building the world's first monitoring system to shine the light on how Google is manipulating elections and society in general. And if you want to follow his work and perhaps even support his team, please visit www.americasdigitalshield.com. That's americasdigitalshield.com. Also, for the Creepy Line documentary I mentioned in which he appears, visit creepyline.org. That's creepyline.org. And for advice on how you can protect the privacy of you and your family, please read Dr. Epstein's tips at www.myprivacytips.com. That's myprivacytips.com. What you've just heard should chill us all to the bone. The internet was not supposed to be a surveillance and manipulation machine. It was supposed to be the great leveler, and the way humanity would finally build a free and equal society that made information and knowledge available to everyone. But instead, Google has turned it into its own machine capable of influencing elections and censoring billions, while also manipulating whole populations into worldwide movements and hysteria on scales that would have made Big Brother blush. And all of that is not some prediction for the future. It's here now.
And what happens next is up to whether we listen to people like Dr. Robert Epstein or not. My name is Alastair Harding, and you've been listening to Our Digital Future only on Reality Check Radio.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.